Blog Talk Radio. This is Rare Bird Radio. I'm Rich Ferguson, L.A. poet, musician, performer, author of the poetry collection Eighth and Agony out on Punk Hostage Press, and you are listening to Poetescape. Welcome, everyone. Today I am very pleased to have as my guest the lovely and talented writer Erica Ray. How are you, Erica?
Hi, I'm doing great. How are you doing, Rich?
Doing well. Erica Ray is the author of Devangelical, a humorous and touching memoir about growing up evangelical. It's out on Emergency Press. Erica is also the editor-in-chief at Scream Magazine and nonfiction editor at The Nervous Breakdown. We love The Nervous Breakdown. www.thenervousbreakdown.com. Erica also earned her MA in Literature and Linguistics from the University of Hong Kong, and to this day can ask where the bathroom is in Cantonese, although it is likely that she will not understand the answer. Speaking of which, Erica, how do you ask for the location of the bathroom in Cantonese?
You ready?
Yes. Nice.
Yeah, is that all right? I might have insulted your grandmother, though. It's possible.
Can you tell the audience a little about Devangelical?
Sure. Devangelical is basically about my life growing up in the evangelical church. I was a very good Christian little girl. Basically part of a culture that we didn't cuss, we didn't dance, we didn't drink alcohol. All those things were considered sins and would land us in hell. So that's basically what I grew up in. And then at some point, right after college in my grad school years, I suddenly found myself outside of that looking in and was kind of confused and baffled and a bit shocked because I had played it by the book so well. And so it was basically a time where I sat down. Writing the book for me was like writing down just what happened, trying to figure out what happened. And I found that there were a lot of things that sort of just made me chuckle and a lot of stories that, you know, once I had found myself distanced from it all, seemed completely amazing and almost even unbelievable that I was a part of that. So anyway, it's just basically just looking back on my life and trying to figure out what happened.
Nice. So what does the term devangelical mean to you?
Well, for me, it was stepping outside of the evangelical church. And really, I found myself outside of it. It wasn't so much deliberate at first. And I just found myself outside of it. I later sort of have put that term to use more as a commentary about the culture of the church. I'm very careful to avoid discussing the faith into critical terms, but definitely the culture of the church, as far as I'm concerned, is fair game.
So you spoke about it briefly just before, but I was wondering if you could address a little further how you were raised in the church.
Sure. You know, my parents were both Christian academics. My father was a president of a Christian college, a couple Christian colleges. My mom was a professor. Both of them had PhDs. Very educated people. They basically took my sisters and me around the world for different trips. They tried their hardest to expose us to culture. Somehow, in spite of that, I went very radical in my teen years, and I got involved in a church that really was quite fundamentalist and very focused on sin, and every little infraction basically would land you in hell. So we were constantly watching our backs. We believed that there were angels and demons with us in the room at any time, you know, just fighting for our souls, hiding our keys from us, whatever,
wow.
Tempting us to have sex with our boyfriends, all that sort of thing. So we were always on the alert, always worried about dying, always worried about being taken away at any moment and whether we were measuring up.
So what made you go so radical in high school? Was it basically you just sort of bumping up against all these beliefs that you had grown up with and now was sort of your period of rebellion, or what happened exactly?
You know, I think when you are in high school, there are a number of things at play here. And one of the things, top priority here, is hormone. Hormones. So basically, you know, you're constantly well, there's this pull, right? And there's this attraction, and there's this, you know, you don't know what to do with it, especially as a teenager. So when you're with the church, there's this huge push to refocus that sexual energy onto the church, and basically saying, you know, don't be hot for boys, be hot for God instead. So there's this kind of interesting kind of gathering in of the flock in high school, trying to keep people pure. So a lot of youth group is really focused on that, as far as I'm concerned, you know, just basically trying to be a replacement for sex, and just trying to get all those kind of crazy hormonal channels in the right direction. So there's that. There's also just the fact that, you know, we think we're immortal anyway as teens. So if somebody tells you that you're not going to die, and that if the rapture might be happening any minute too, and the rapture, if you're, in case you're not familiar, is when the evangelicals say that Jesus will return and basically just pull his people up into the air. So it's kind of a way to skip death,
right?
And it could happen at any time. So there was a big rapture scare as well while I was in high school. That was in 1988.
Mm-hmm.
So probably those things focused together were, you know, right in line.
Yeah. You know, as you just put it before, and as you put it in the book, you were trying to be hot for God and not each other. And you even go as far as to suggest that one of the church youth group's main functions was to provide an alternative to sex. How did that work for you overall?
Well, I mean, you know, nature finds a way. I mean, I always joke about that, because, you know, a lot of people look at the teens in the church and look how pure and how good everybody's being. But really, if you kind of tear back the veil a bit, there's a lot of substitution going on. There's,
right.
There's a lot of marching up to that line and then, you know, not crossing the actual technical line in a very Bill Clinton sort of way.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
You know, there's a really touching section toward the end of your book where you have a fight with your father not long before he passed away. I was wondering if you could talk a little about what led up to that and its aftermath, how it affected you.
Well, what led up to that was that I had basically left the church behind, and it wasn't like I had made a huge statement to my family. It's just that I wasn't going. So I had just attended University of Hong Kong for 2 years. I did my grad work there. And I came back, and I had not been going to church at all. And I came back to the States and was still not going to church. And I think it really bothered my dad. Well, the truth was that I actually wanted to find a church. It's just that I didn't want to find one that was so conservative. So I ended up kind of landing in a place that he considered to be way, way subpar, basically. As far as he was concerned, it was what he would call New Agey. You know,
right.
In other words, and really all that comes down to, as far as I'm concerned, is they allowed people their questions, and they didn't, you know, necessarily tell you what to believe, but they believed in the community and they believed in social justice and some factors that I really liked at the time, especially, and they meant a lot to me. Well, he came for a visit and he was not so happy about it. And he wasn't an angry type of man. In fact, he always had a good humor, but he kind of started really dropping a lot of hints to me about a church that I needed to be going to in the area. So so I basically told him, you know, that I wasn't interested in that, and that I had found a place I belonged, but he wasn't very happy about it. So he kept pushing, and I kind of blew up at him. So that was a fight that I talk about in the back of the book. But he was also dying from a brain tumor at the time, and he probably only had about 5-6 months left after that. So there's this kind of reckoning, I suppose, over the next few months where, you know, I think I was trying to be understood by him, but he couldn't understand me anymore because his brain was not functioning normally. So it was kind of an interesting sort of thing where I had to realize that I had to understand him, that it was up to me, and that I didn't need to demand understanding from him
right.
so much as I needed to be understanding. So,
wow. Yeah, I have to say it's really such a touching section of the book. It just really took my breath away, that whole
Thank
section.
You. Families are difficult, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. As a line from the Jim Jarmusch film, Down by Law, I think it was Down by Law, a sad and beautiful thing, yes.
Yeah, and they've always been so supportive of me, you know, through everything, and they've not been the type of family to disown me for what I think or what I believe. They've always been very supportive, but at the same time, you know, when you have disagreements, especially when they think that you're going to hell for what you believe, there are some problems, and there's some genuine concern on their part.
So. Sure, sure. Hey, I was wondering, well, I was hoping that you might be able to read a section from the book.
I would love to.
That would be great. Anytime you're ready.
Okay. All right. I'm gonna read from a section. This is while I was living in Hong Kong, and it's basically a girlfriend of mine there who I met. She's a British girl, and she was somebody I met in one of my Wing Chun Kung Fu classes. So that's
Is this from the God is a DJ section?
Yeah, I'm gonna go with God is a
Great.
DJ. Is that all right?
Great. Oh yeah, I love that section.
Okay. She was unapologetically beautiful with ocean-damp hair and breasts that pressed two dark spots into her pink camisole. Light freckles on her nose matched her sand-crusted toes, and she walked the leaf-shadowed path as if she wore the weight of a hidden royal past. Around us on all sides were the spinning dementia of cicadas and the love affairs of bullfrogs. Nature saturated the damp air. We passed from the trees into the cane forest, and out past the chicken yard where the hens bickered openly and the cock was king. We spoke of love and culture and sex and God. She had been raised in the same British boarding school as Cat Stevens. Oh, yes, she remembered the old schoolyard. Our conversation, like our path, meandered heavily. Love is a battlefield. Culture is a club. Sex is natural. God is a DJ. We passed under a cicada mist, and our faces moistened with their sticky insanity. She told me that she loved me, without shame. She had love to spare. She was beautiful, is beautiful still in my memory. I took her arm and called her sister. She made me feel beautiful by association, the kind of beauty that doesn't care if every hair is in place or whether blemishes show. That kind of beauty is rare, from the soul, within. She didn't believe in God, she said. She told me that she used to ask the nuns at her school to explain things and got rapped on the knuckles by a wooden ruler on more than one occasion. She said she could not even conceive of God. At night, she lay awake trying to imagine one. She wanted to pray to God, to find God, but had come up empty. I didn't know what to say, how to respond. I honestly thought that everybody knew there was a God. Sure, I had heard of atheists, but I figured they did not believe because they did not want to. Chloe wanted to, and still she could not. After several months of me chipping away at the subject, her expression began to change. She wasn't looking at me filled with empathy for my lack of understanding anymore. She was genuinely distraught. I don't know why I can't conceive of God, she would tell me, eyebrows knitted with worry. I want to. I really do. What's wrong with me? I backed off. I hadn't meant to alarm her. It's just that I had never met someone like her before. I had heard people say that they didn't care about the idea of God. I had heard people say that God is a social construct and that there is no proof. I'd even heard people say, if God exists, then he is unjust and I don't want any part of him. But what she was saying was different. What she was saying rocked my very foundation. One night, Chloe and I stood together on the shore of the South China Sea. Before us, the ocean hushed on the downbeat while we practiced the forms of our art. Slowly, we speared and parried our energy into the breeze and then back upon ourselves. Tan Sao, Fuk Sao, Bong Sao. Others in our class spread around and behind us. Before us was the inky green of the ocean at night, rhythmic and regular in its white-tipped entropy. Tan Sao, Fuk Sao, Bong Sao. Take energy, give energy, round and back again. My eyes focused beyond the black over the water, not understanding what I was seeing at first. It was the crest of a wave, a piece of trash, an angel on the breeze. It floated toward me, drifting with design. Upon realizing that this otherworldly thing was alive, I moved toward it, leaving the rest of my class behind me on the higher sand. I was compelled toward it. Its glowing wings flowed and rippled as if slack on their frames. Tassels hung from them, spread wider than the diameter of my hand from thumb to pinky. It was beautiful. My God, it was beautiful. It must have been a large moth, but but it hardly seemed as if it could be from this earth. Who would believe me? Was it actually a moth? It was so big. I wanted to touch it. I wanted to be blessed by it and learn from it. I reached for it. Inches from my hand, I could see it. Our souls connected, and my blood paused in its channels. I felt it then, its energy, its purity, its wings as beautiful as infant's breath, its large dark eyes as black and terrifying as the night sky. It pierced me to my core, the truth of it. And yet, just as it was about to land on my finger, I withdrew my hand out of fear. I cursed myself for my own weakness, for the opportunity lost. I returned slowly toward my class and walked back up the beach.
It's beautiful, Erica.
Thank you.
You know, this is something we discussed prior to this show, too. You know, there's such a beautiful poetry to this section of the memoir, and most of what you write these days is indeed prose, but I love what you said to me, how you sometimes use poetry to get at your prose. I was wondering if you could talk a little about that process.
Sure. You know, I started my writing as a poet, actually, and I tried for many years to be a poet, to be published. I had a lot of trouble doing that. But it really became an exercise that I used just for myself to get my own feelings out. And so now when I sit down and I work on a story or a novel or a memoir, whatever I'm working on, I often try to just put things into poetry first before I do that, and then later I end up turning it into prose. So it's kind of a writing exercise for me.
Sure.
You know, get my soul out.
Exactly. You know, however we can do that, you know, getting the soul out. So you, absolutely. You know, you're extremely humble when crediting people and assisting you with the evolution of your book, everyone from your husband, Scott, to your editor, Brian Tomasevich at Emergency Press, to some of the good folks at the Nervous Breakdown, including Nick Bellardes, Jan Blaine, Megan DeLillo, and our boss, TMB founder Brad Listy. Yay, Brad! I'm wondering if you could talk a little about the process of writing the memoir, and what did it look like in some of its earlier incarnations, and how did the feedback of others help it to take its ultimate shape?
I think I might be a TMB success story because basically, you know, I really tried out a lot of these stories on the Nervous Breakdown as we were going along, and a lot of them were written then for people who I knew, or I at least assumed were outside of the culture that I had grown up in. I mean, granted, the evangelical culture is about 35% of the U.S., so it's a pretty big, strong group. But, you know, I find talking to at least most people that I run in circles with now that they have absolutely no idea. And, you know, I've said before that not knowing about the evangelical culture is a lot like not knowing about the Mexican-American community during all the immigration discussion.
Right.
You know, and I think it's something that, you know, if people want to understand what's going on in this country and want to understand politics, it's actually kind of interesting.
Sure.
So I originally wrote this as sort of a handbook.
Right.
And I put kind of funny little definitions at the top of each chapter, just trying to explain what all these terms meant that we were talking about, like salvation and what an altar call was, that sort of thing. So,
right.
So that was kind of the original sort of motion of this book. And then it just turned out that I was just having so much fun writing these stories down and making myself laugh with the memories. But
right.
Going. Yeah.
Yeah. Not only in terms of the evangelical faith, but maybe thinking more globally, how do you feel religion best serves people? And how do you think, if at all, it may fail them? And also, how do you think religious followers best serve their faith? And how do you think they might give a bad name to the church?
I think religion is at its best when it's focused on helping people's neighbors. You know, and that's something that I returned to in the book a few times. You know, we were talking about how we were doing what God said to do in the book so many in our lives growing up so many times, but really a lot of Christianity comes down to a very simple statement in the words of Jesus in the Bible that was basically love God with all your heart and love your neighbor. Beyond that, there's nothing else. I mean, that's it. So I think religion is at its best when it's focused on helping each other.
Mm-hmm.
It's at its worst when it loses sight of that and forgets to actually help people in this world and is so absorbed with saving souls or saving people that it forgets about the actual needs of other people.
Right, right.
So that's when it turns violent.
Sure, sure. And how do you think followers give religion a bad name, or the evangelical, or however you want to put it?
Oh, well, there are a lot of ways, but definitely in taking religious text completely literally and trying to enforce certain interpretations on those texts, I think people get in a lot of trouble. And it can turn it sort of ugly because, big example would be the whole homosexual marriage, the same-sex marriage.
Sure.
Debates going on. A lot of the evangelical world, and not all of the evangelical world, there are 1,000 different denominations represented in that world, but quite a large percentage points to the 7 verses in the Bible that basically call out homosexuality. But the problem is, if you start really looking at what the texts mean themselves, they're not necessarily talking about homosexuality. So it's kind of this rigid interpretation that has been followed, I want to say traditionally, but it's actually morphed over the years, just like language has morphed over the years.
Right.
And a lot of the terminology used in the Bible where you see the English word homosexuality was not actually translated from a word that originally meant homosexuality. So there are some problems there. And when you take those things completely literally, this is just an example, of course, of many things, but insist that other people follow your interpretation and insist that your way is right, it brings out kind of an ugliness that I don't think is really behind the intent of Christianity or any other religion.
Right.
At its roots.
So what does faith look like for you these days?
Faith is a tricky one.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it really is. For me, there are so many questions. I'm a postmodern girl. You're a postmodern guy. I mean, we've been raised with ways to look at things, interpretations. As another example, just back to the interpretation thing. We basically deconstruct everything to pieces, don't we? I mean, that's just what we do in our society. Taking something for certainty is difficult, and faith in itself, I don't think, was ever meant to be based on a certainty. So a lot of people have turned faith into a certainty, and I think that actually takes away from the word faith because you almost have to introduce an element of doubt in there because believing that I am sitting on a chair is not the same thing as, believing in someone named God,
Right.
So there has to be an element of doubt in there, and there has to be kind of a juxtaposition of those two concepts. So for me, faith, it's a very different definition than it used to be for me. And really it comes down more to a hope that everything's going to be okay and that maybe someone's out there looking out for me. That would be nice. So
yes.
I can buy into hoping that that's happening.
Sure, sure. So how do you talk to your kids about spirituality? I'm going to ask you some questions about your family in a moment, but
yeah, sure.
How do you talk to them about all this?
Well, I've got 3 kids, as you know, and my oldest is 9. So the others are 5 and 3. They're a little young, but the 9-year-old and I have had a lot of interesting conversations. We've last year in her school, we did a lot of religious studies. So we looked at the roots of Islam, and we looked at Judaism, and we looked at even the roots of Christianity and how it's changed over the years. We've also looked at Viking religion and Roman and Greek, and we've done a huge gamut, Hinduism as well. So she kind of has an understanding that a lot of people believe different things, which I think is really important as a basis. I do take her to church. occasionally. We're not as good as we probably should be, but but I like exposing her to that community. It's a community that does allow questioning and an individual search, and I think that that's important. What her conclusions are, I want to leave up to her, but I think my job is just to at least expose her to the possibilities.
Nice. So speaking of family, and this is something we've spoken about before, and this is something that always amazes me about you. Okay, so I'm going to go through the list here. You have 3 kids, 3 dogs, 1 hamster, 11 chickens, 20,000 bees. By the way, I saw the picture on Facebook the other day, the bees. You also ghostwrite memoirs and resumes for other people. Where do you find the time to write for yourself?
Oh, you forgot. I also run an ISP with my husband.
That's right.
we shoot broadband out from our mountain community. Yeah.
That's right.
You know, it's tricky, and I find that there are some times where I fall behind. But my goal, Rich, is just to write a page a day.
Nice.
And that's not usually that hard. And to be completely truthful, in the last month, I've really kind of fallen behind in that. but if I can just get 1 page a day down, then at least I know I'm moving forward. And it might be total crap, too. That's okay.
Sure.
I kind of have learned to forgive myself for that.
So what are you working on these days? Can you talk about it at all? Or?
Yeah, I've got a lot of things I'm working on, as you pointed out. Like I said, the first thing is I'm a ghostwriter, so I'm working pretty hard on a memoir for somebody else right now, and I'm about to start another one for another person. But as far as my own stuff, I am working on a fiction. Basically, it's about an entrepreneur during the recession, and he's in Boulder, and he's following one of those crazy little business books, you know, that people love to put on the counters at Barnes & Noble. So he's following it around like it's his own personal Bible. So I'm having fun with that. It's kind of a humor sort of book. So there's that, and I'm also working on a sequel to Devangelical at the same time in between it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So I mentioned the bees before. You have 20,000 bees. They live and thrive well up in the high altitudes of Colorado?
Well, we'll see. This is our second year to try. Last year we did this as well, and we had a bear take them out.
Wow.
A couple months in. So hopefully this year works better.
Okay. Now, I would be remiss if I didn't bring this up in our conversation. You're way into martial arts, and we've, you know, both spoken about Bruce Lee numerous times. I was wondering if you could talk about briefly, we're getting close to the end of our time, but we have a little time left. Where did martial arts fit into your climb out of the church?
It actually fit It actually helped bring me out, which is kind of an interesting and maybe scary thing for some evangelicals to hear. but basically, it exposed me to a very different way of thinking. But more importantly was that it helped me get over a lot of fears that I had just about where I was in the world and what could happen to me. Because, you know, that was very prominent in my thoughts. About, you know, what could, you know, like I told you before, mortality was such a huge issue in my mind at all times. So it was kind of a way to help me conquer some fears. So I joined into this class, and I got into that scary thing called energy, which, or at least I was confronted with it, you know, because evangelicals are very scared of that. They think it's just demons talking.
Right.
So, you know, I learned that it's not quite as scary as all that. And but basically, it helped me, I think, just become exposed to a very different way of looking at things and overcome a lot of what I was afraid of.
Yeah. You know, I mentioned Bruce Lee before, and we both admire him greatly, think of him as a god in his own way. And, you know, not only was he a badass fighting machine, but he was actually quite the philosopher, as I'm sure you know, and quite quotable. And one of my favorite Bruce Lee sayings is, "The key to immortality is first living a life worth remembering." And I'm wondering, Erica, how do you go about achieving that goal for yourself, living a life worth remembering?
Wow, that's really a deep question, Rich.
Yeah.
You should have passed me that question ahead of time so I could think of it. You know what, though? I think living every day where you at least make a difference for somebody or make a quantifiable difference for yourself as well, moving forward toward your goals, I mean, that's huge. You know, if I can help one person each day, I mean, that is just huge.
Yes.
If I can do one thing to take a step closer to what my life goals are, then that's huge as well. If I don't take that step closer, then it's kind of a stagnant day. If I didn't help somebody, it's just kind of a stagnant day. I mean, I want to keep moving forward. So
I think that's admirable. And yes, well done. We're getting close to the end of our time. And I'm wondering let people know where they can find you online.
Of course, yep. I have a website. It's devangelical.com. That's probably the best place. You can also find me all over The Nervous Breakdown. Of course,
I love your. I was visiting your website, and I was watching your video for your photo shoot for the book cover, and enjoyed it immensely. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today, Erica. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Rich. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and I want to send out a big thank you also to our show's sponsor. For all your writerly needs, please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Juliet Rare Bird Lit. You can find them online at rarebirdlit.com. And you can find me online at wevoicesing.com, YouTube, Facebook, Amazon for my poetry collection, Eighth and Agony. Next week, my guest will be author, nutritionist, musician, and all-around great guy, Sid Garza Hillman, discussing his latest book, Approaching the Natural, A Health Manifesto. We'll also be playing some of his music, so you don't want to miss that. It's really great. Until then, I'm Rich Ferguson, and thanks for tuning in to another episode of Poetescape.